MacCast, Sunday, March 10th, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, does it feel to you, just a little bit, maybe, because it certainly does to me, like this year is going by way too fast? Yeah, I don't know what's going on. It's March 10th already. That is just crazy to me. I guess the good news is that means we might be getting close to an Apple event. Yeah, there's that one we're thinking might happen toward the end of the month here. So we're going to, of course, be talking a little bit about some things related to that in this week's episode. But we also have a bunch of other Mac and Apple news to dive into. We're going to be talking a little bit more about Apple's original video content and maybe some troubles that are brewing there, or Apple maybe getting a little more involved than it should. Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit. Also, rumors about new AirPods. Going to talk a little bit about privacy and Apple. And also some acquisitions. We've got some foldable phone stuff and how that relates to Apple in here. Also, updates on Apple Store in Australia, along with some new policies regarding iPhone repairs, which are actually pretty exciting, and also some updates to Siri, music playlists, a whole bunch of good Apple news and information. And of course, we're also going to get to some of your feedback questions and those sorts of things. We're going to be talking about passwords and keychains, and talking about a little bit more about encryption and how to protect your files. We've got a question about boot camp in a future world where Macs may be a little bit different, and also going to get into Siri shortcuts, and we'll round things out with a thing of the moment. We haven't done one of those in a while, and I made a change to my home automation setup that I want to talk to you about, and I'll explain why that happened and what product I ended up installing. And that should round out this episode of the MacCast. So let's not delay at all. Let's just jump right into some of the latest news, kicking off things with a piece in the New York Post that claims that Apple executives may be getting a little bit too close to their original video content projects. Sources say that agents and producers are sort of not happy with Apple and their quote-unquote intrusive executives. They've been calling them, quote, difficult to deal with, and saying that there is a general lack of clarity or transparency over what Apple wants with the show. So the general complaint is that Apple is getting a little bit too involved. I found this piece to be a little bit funny because, hey, it's Apple. They like to be very involved in all of their projects. Unfortunately, that's something that most talent and producers generally don't like when they're trying to create a vision for what they're trying to produce. They don't want a lot of hand-holding. They don't want a lot of people telling them what to do. They kind of want to work on their own creative projects and be left alone. That's a common theme in Hollywood, and one of the reasons why a lot of producers and talent want to go to places like Amazon or Netflix, where they get a little more creative freedom. So Apple stepping in there might not be the best move. The piece specifically calls out Tim Cook, saying that he has given many notes to the runners of various shows and programs that they're developing. And he said one of the most common ones was, quote unquote, don't be so mean. Now, we don't know which show they're talking about. It did say that he had gone on set for a number of the various shows, including the one titled C, which I believe is a sci-fi drama show and is the one starring Jason Momoa from Game of Thrones and the latest Aquaman. So I don't know if that's specifically the show that he was sending those notes to, but regardless, they haven't been very well appreciated, apparently, in the Hollywood community. We are still getting reports that really one of the things that Apple is looking to do is create a more family-friendly approach to content. And this latest report also adds that they want a generally positive portrayal of technology's role in their shows, meaning they kind of don't want to show technology being used for bad things, which is a little bit odd if you ask me. It sounds especially bad if you're trying to develop a sci-fi show. A lot of those themes come up quite frequently where technology has gone wrong, and that's what makes sci-fi shows kind of cool sometimes. So I hope that's not the direction that they're moving in. But as Apple keeps doing this stuff, there becomes more and more frustration because it's seeming to lead to possible delays in the launch of Apple's new video services. So that is also frustrating a number of the producers and people making these shows because they want to get that content out there. Now, we are expecting that Apple is going to have an announcement related to some of their new services here on at the end of the month, like on the 25th. And they may announce the service, but may not have it actually ready to go. It's expected they may even show some clips, show some of the content that they've been working on. So, you know, this could be a contributing factor into that service being delayed, which kind of stinks all the way around. Another thing that the piece points out, though, is that, you know, Apple is kind of new to this game, behind Netflix and Amazon and even companies like Disney, who are more familiar with working in Hollywood, and that there has been this sort of Hollywood, Silicon Valley, you know, growing pains that Netflix and Amazon especially had to go through as they were producing their own content. So Apple may be feeling just a little bit of that as well. It's interesting to me that these problems are surfacing with the executives because they did hire, you know, the two guys from Sony and a lot of executive talent from Hollywood to kind of control this stuff. The piece also talks about them kind of calling producers and people up to Silicon Valley too frequently to kind of have conversations about the way shows are going. But once again, I kind of find it not surprising because it's Apple, right? They are very hands-on. And this is one of the things that I worried about when Apple started to diversify into areas like content production. It's not really their wheelhouse, and they seem to be doing the right thing by hiring, you know, people out of Hollywood. I think they kind of maybe need to take a little more hands-off approach and let those guys do what they know how to do. The piece does say this is all affecting the quality of, potentially the quality of the shows as well, which is not really good to hear. I've been generally excited about this new service, and this was the first little bit of news that made me a little bit more tentative about it. I am very excited about the idea of more family-friendly content. I think we talked about that here on the show. But again, if that is stifling creative freedom, if they start to upset too much of this talent, that could be a long-term problem for Apple and for the service. So, you know, despite all of these complaints, though, it doesn't seem like Apple is having any issues attracting that top talent, at least not for the current moment, because just this week, Variety reported on a new straight-to-series drama coming from that's going to be starring Captain Marvel's Brie Larson. It's a CIA drama based on the memoirs of a real CIA undercover operative. So another great-sounding series, something that I would be very excited to watch coming to Apple, starring, you know, A-list talent, the star of the new Captain Marvel movie. So, you know, Apple is, I think, creating some potentially great programming. If it's going to realize that, I think they're going to have to learn to definitely work a little bit differently, especially when it comes to this kind of content. But, you know, it's really too early to judge, and these are all just rumors. You know, a lot of speculation just coming from people inside the industry who are leaking information to sources like Variety and stuff like that. So we'll have to wait and see. I think Apple's gonna pull it off. I am still pretty excited about it. One other sort of entertainment-related thing that came up this week, although I will say it's a little bit of a sketchy report, there seems to be some evidence that possibly videos in iTunes have been cracked, that the DRM has been broken. Several sites are reporting that there is a version of Aquaman in 4K that has surfaced online. The information came out of Torrent Freak, and they were speculating that the version could be a cracked edition from iTunes. Now, why do they think this? Well, the name of the file. Yeah, that's where the sketchy part comes in, because of course that could be changed. Basically, it had webdl in the file name, web-dl, which specifically generally refers to web downloaded content from streaming services like Hulu, Amazon, or iTunes. And it was in 4K, or reportedly in 4K, and iTunes was one of the few places that you could actually get a 4K copy of Aquaman. It wasn't available on any of the other streaming download services. Now, the piece did note that there was a 4K Vudu version, that's the service from Walmart, that surfaced, but that showed up before the release of the film. So I think it's entirely possible that that's what it could be, and it's just simply renamed in a way that makes it look like it maybe came from iTunes. As far as I know, iTunes DRM has not been cracked. Now, since the release of this Aquaman 4K version on the torrents, there also have shown up a couple of versions of a few other new movies in 4K, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and Can You Ever Forgive Me? So more and more places are kind of reporting that this is coming out of iTunes. I think it's too early to confirm that, but just something interesting that did happen this week. How would you like it if your AirPods were able to charge a lot faster, and if they could do that charging wirelessly? Yeah, I think that's something all of us would be very excited about, especially if it came in the new version of AirPods. Well, we got a story this week, or some information this week. Now, once again, it's coming from a somewhat questionable source, but basically a user from a mobile developers community claimed on Twitter that AirPod 2s would have fast wireless Qi charging, and not only that, that charging could happen in about 15 minutes. So going from 0 to 100% in 15 minutes for both the AirPods and the wireless charging case. Now, he did say in his tweet that that would require the case to be slightly bigger in, quote, one direction and heavier to accommodate that kind of fast charging. But if that turns out to be true, that could be very interesting. Now, what his connections are and why he would have that information, that is the somewhat questionable part. So I'm only bringing it up because it surfaced this week. I'm not placing too much stock in it, but I do want to have the conversation about how interesting that would be, right? I think many of us would welcome, you know, quick charging on our AirPods. To be fair, AirPods charge back up fairly quickly, especially the AirPods themselves. I have generally found if I have them go dead, I can put them in the case, you know, for 30 minutes or so and get up a pretty good charge. So I don't have too many complaints in that department, but anytime it can be faster or better, yeah, that's going to be something that I'm excited about. Of course, we are expecting AirPod 2s to surface sometime soon. There's a little bit of debate on when that will happen. And as far as what the features are, if you remember, we've been hearing a number of different things. Most recently, a possible black color option, Hey Siri support, noise cancellation, although I still maintain I'd love to have the option. I'd love that to be a toggleable setting, so something you can turn on or off. I think it should be doable within the software. Also, improved water resistance. We had heard about a new sort of grippier coating, kind of a soft touch glass, almost frosted glass kind of coating, and also additional health features, including heart rate monitoring. Although the big question on any new health features would be, what kind of impact would that have on battery life? I think noise cancellation is also a concern when it comes to battery life as well, along with Hey Siri support. So all of these things, I think, are tentative just because that would be a lot for Apple to pull off. But I think any couple of these options or new features would be amazing for a new set of AirPods. We're also unfortunately hearing that the AirPods might go up in price, and I have a feeling that's not only just new features, but also could be just because of the popularity of AirPods. You know, Apple can probably make a little bit more off of them, and people will probably be willing to pay up. The one thing that's being debated is the actual release dates of AirPod X2s. Some people are thinking that the product might not arrive until later this year because of Apple needing to work out some of these new features. But there also, of course, have been inklings and whispers that Apple could announce the new product at the event that may take place on March 25th. So might be sooner than later. I think it's been about, 2 years since we got AirPods? It probably is time for the AirPods to surface. And when they do, we can expect Apple to do some marketing. There's sure to be some new TV ads, although probably not the TV ad that you may have seen this week. Several news sites, including Mac Rumors, were fooled by a fake AirPod 2 ad that showed up online this week. It all turned out to be something put out by a PR company. Unfortunately, some of the Mac News websites had to post updates and sort of retractions. It seemed like it was coming from reliable sources, but there you go. Anybody can be fooled. And I don't fault them too much. You know, we're all excited about these new products coming out. And it's hard to vet a lot of this information, right? You do your best to follow up on it. And occasionally, some of this stuff gets by you. And that did happen this week. So if you did see that new AirPod 2 ad, yep, not from Apple. It was a fake from a PR company. So here's something that I found pretty hard to believe and something I'd maybe like your opinion on. I want to get some opinions from the community because I'm not entirely certain how something like this could happen. But there was a new report out this week from SmartHQ, which is a behavioral marketing company, and they did a survey of consumers, 1,000 consumers, about privacy and concerns about privacy concerns, brand experiences, and their personal preferences when it comes to marketing and what companies do with their personal data. And in this report, they claim that consumers are almost twice as trustful of, wait for it, not Apple, of Amazon with handling their personal data versus Apple. Yes, Amazon twice as trustful with our personal data as Apple. This is according, again, to this SmartHQ report. They said that, of course, 86% of consumers said they were concerned about their data privacy and that 79% said that they feel companies know too much about them. But what was interesting was that 90% of those being asked said they would be willing to share their behavioral data in exchange for making their shopping experiences easier and actually more accurately cheaper. It turned out a lot of people were willing to give up their personal information for a discount. Yeah, that's a little bit shocking. How much personal information is probably not a question that they really asked. But when they asked which companies consumers felt were using their data responsibly, only 26.6% said Apple was. And even more shocking, guess what percentage said that Google was using their data responsibly. Yeah, 26.2%, almost exactly the same as Apple. Amazingly, almost half, 48.3%, said that Amazon was using their data responsibly. I'm really curious what data they think Amazon isn't using that they've been collecting from them through their dots and their echoes and their shopping data and their viewing data on Amazon Prime Video and their music data. Yeah, guys, yeah, it was just really bizarre to me. So I am very, very curious what you think about this. Is this something that is just out there? You know, it's an edge case thing, or is this really how consumers are feeling outside of maybe the known tech community? I know we're all geeks and nerds here and we kind of follow this stuff. Apple has put this huge focus on security and privacy. I figured and felt that they had been being pretty vocal about it, that it had been covered in the mainstream media very well, but maybe not so much. And I'm curious why people think, why such a large percentage of people wouldn't think that Apple was protecting their data. Is it maybe just because of the volume of information, because of how many iPhones are out there? Not really sure, but I was baffled a little bit by this one. The report also did say that email was the most preferred way consumers would like brands to interact interact with them, which is also surprising considering how much spam we get, right? But when I think about it, as far as opt-in stuff, yeah, if a company's going to interact with me, I'd prefer that they send me marketing offers and those sorts of things over email versus any other way. The number one thing consumers hated most about this kind of marketing or behavioral marketing by companies was to get push notifications. And I think we all know we get way too many notifications already. You don't really need ones with special offers. And we've seen this from developers sometimes with apps, and it's generally poorly, you know, very badly received. Another interesting bit of data that they talked about in this study was what are kinds of creepy marketing tactics that companies are using that really bother us. And things like website chat pop-ups that use artificial intelligence. Yeah, when you go to a website and it prompts you to help you with your shopping experience, but you know it's a robot, not a real human, that's really annoying. Also, they found that your data following you around to various websites when you don't want it to, that's also creepy and annoying as well. So push notifications featuring brands or products that you've looked up in the past, so not even things that you've purchased, but also just things that you've looked at. Push notifications asking you to repurchase consumable products like razors or toothpaste and things like that, that people found very annoying. Also push notifications for features or products that you purchased in the past. I think generally anytime it feels like companies are sort of watching what you're buying. And what's funny about this is I think Amazon's one of the most egregious about that. I go to Amazon and look at something and suddenly I'm seeing ads for that product everywhere online. Right? We've all experienced this, I think. So it's just crazy. And then finally, ads featuring products or brands that you've looked at in the past. You know, that's exactly what I'm talking about, right? When that stuff follows you around, that is really creepy and annoying. So just an odd little survey, maybe showing that Apple has a bit further to go with sort of proving its privacy worthiness to consumers at the very least. So There you have it. Send me your thoughts, maccast@gmail.com. Heard about an interesting new acquisition by Apple this week. Apparently, Apple picked up the patent portfolio for a failed home security camera company called Lighthouse AI. It seems that Apple is likely interested in patents from the company related to computer vision, facial recognition, and object detection. There were also patents in the portfolio related to depth sensing camera systems and also doing depth sensing and image detection in low light, all things that seem perfect applications for a number of various Apple products. The patents were actually purchased back in December, but only surfaced in February, due to their appearance on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office database. So the transfer kind of showed up, and that's why we're hearing about it now. Lighthouse had been trying to compete against other camera companies like Ring, Nest, and Waze, but didn't quite make it and had to close up shop, and then Apple picked up these patents. It's interesting, though, because the company had some really cool technology centered around things like 3D sensing and also facial recognition. So they had cameras that could actually detect and remember the faces of homeowners, family members, and frequent visitors, I would imagine, so that they wouldn't have false positives for some of the security stuff. So you come into your house, it could recognize that it's you and maybe immediately disable the camera system or the security system, which would be really, really cool. And you can imagine this could be very helpful for Apple for a future version of, say, the HomePod or the Apple TV, where it could actually use cameras and facial recognition, maybe even voice identification to recognize multiple users of the same household and then react differently based on the commands from those users, right? So the ability to know that I want to send text messages versus my kids sending text messages, those sorts of things. Something that a lot of people have been asking about with the HomePod since it was launched. You know, when are we going to get multi-user? We also could use that on the Apple TV, especially when it comes to the TV app and watching behavior and stuff like that. The company also had vision systems that could filter out low light noise and pet movements, so get rid of some of those false detections and any kind of low light technology that would have really good applications for future versions of iPhone cameras and things like that. So it's doubtful that Apple wants to take the patents and actually make a video camera product for HomeKit, although I guess they could at some point. But the patents, as we've been pointing out, could be useful across a number of Apple products like the iPhone, maybe rolled into Face ID technologies, of course, the HomePod, which I already talked about. There's augmented reality and virtual reality applications with some of the depth sensing systems. And also, I would imagine there's potential applications in Apple's autonomous systems projects. So seems like a good portfolio for Apple to have picked up. And it'll be interesting to see what ways it works into future technologies from Apple. Something we've been talking about the last couple of episodes is the new foldable phones that have surfaced from Samsung and Huawei. And the big question in a lot of Apple fans' minds is this a technology that Apple will adopt at some point? We already have pretty good evidence that Apple is exploring it. They're looking at prototypes and things like that. One sticking point for Apple may be the materials, though, because those current phones, they have to use polymer displays. They cannot use glass, and we don't have bendable glass yet. But guess what? Corning, Apple's main glass developer, maybe only glass supplier, it says they're working on it. They're trying to get flexible glass displays. As a matter of fact, they already have them in a technology called Willow Glass. That glass can actually be rolled up. The problem with it is that it is very thin and maybe not so impact resistant. All of our phones right now use some form of Corning Gorilla Glass, which is much more durable, but of course not bendable. So the company is looking to combine those two glass technologies, merge those two properties together, and that is the big challenge for them. Right now, that Willow Glass is just 0.1 millimeters thick, just a tenth of a millimeter thick, and it can actually be bent to a radius of about 5 millimeters. So that's a pretty tight bend on that. But in order to achieve that, that glass needs to go through a process of being dipped into a molten salt solution. And unfortunately, that salt would corrode any transistors found in display applications. So you basically ruin the displays if you were trying to apply that flexible glass. So they are working on it. They actually claim that they have some glass that customers are already sampling. If Apple has some of that glass, they're not saying it, but they potentially could and be working on prototypes. But they say currently that glass is not meeting all of the specification requirements. And I'm assuming where it's most likely failing is in that impact resistance, right? So it's going to be great to have a flexible glass screen, but if you drop the phone and it cracks, you know, anytime it hits a surface, that is going to be a huge problem. But they are working on it, so we could have foldable glass displays in the future. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that Apple will develop a foldable phone. I think Apple's going to take a wait and see on this technology, because right now, these early models we're seeing, it's a lot of public R&D. We've already heard reports that Samsung and Huawei and other manufacturers are already thinking about other kinds of designs to throw out into the marketplace because they want to see what quote-unquote sticks. So they're going to use the consumers as their public R&D, and not something that Apple typically likes to do. They like to find an actual application to know or even be able to tell consumers why this product exists, why they want to use it, and how they're going to use it. That's a very different approach than some of these other companies. But I have to imagine that Apple may wait for flexible glass displays to come out before they even venture into this category, and they may actually never do that. So only time will tell. Few other things related to possible future iPhones I want to talk to you about this week. Apple might have a 5G modem problem in 2020 if they're not able to maybe settle up some of their disputes with Qualcomm. This is coming out of some analyst reports. At issue is the fact that Apple is waiting to launch a 5G iPhone until 2020, and they are planning on using Intel modems, at least according to most recent reports. Apple has had a falling out with Qualcomm, and Intel has been their modem supplier. Apple is generally not first to market with 5G. We do know that we're seeing some 5G phones hitting the market already right now. The problem is that carrier networks are not going to be really up to date and ready for 5G until maybe the end of this year or sometime in 2020. They're doing a slow rollout. Some places will have 5G this year, but not a lot. So being able to take advantage of that is not going to happen till 2020, and that's why we're expecting Apple to have phones at that point. But the problem comes in the fact that Intel won't ever have mmWave capabilities in their modems, and that is the technology that uses 5G's highest speed wireless communications protocols. So even if Apple did hit the market with an Intel modem 5G phone in 2020, they're still going to be behind the other companies who have potentially already had 5G phones in the market for up to 18 months. So Apple's going to be looking like they're very far behind those other companies. Now, they could pivot and use another supplier like Samsung or Qualcomm, but that seems unlikely. Another thing that we've been hearing a lot about is Apple potentially creating their own modems. We do know that they have engineers and people on staff working on cellular modems, including 5G modems. So they could potentially just buy Intel's modem business and develop their own chips, but that's likely not going to happen anytime soon, and they might not have those chipsets ready by 2020. So it's going to be interesting to watch and see how Apple adapts to this problem. Maybe they can resolve the thing with Qualcomm, but that's been going on for many, many years now, and I don't see Apple really doing that. So I think the best chance is that Apple ramps things up and develops their own modem technologies, and maybe we'll see an Apple modem in an iPhone in 2020. Another thing that is expected to happen in 2020, at least according to Ming-Chi Kuo, is he says that Apple is getting ready to drop their first augmented reality product. As a matter of fact, it might even come a little bit sooner, according to him. He says it could happen late this year. And this is something that we've also heard from some other sources, including Bloomberg. Ming-Chi Kuo says the product will likely be a headset or glasses, more likely kind of glasses, that would then be connected to an iPhone. So like the Apple Watch, it's expected to be an iPhone accessory, not a standalone or autonomous product. In fact, Ming-Chi Kuo says the first version of this AR product will be, quote, heavily dependent on the iPhone. The glasses would essentially serve as an augmented reality display for the iPhone, and the iPhone would then provide processing, connectivity, all the other features for the experience. And so the idea would be that you could have stuff popping up right on your display, messages, information, directions, all those sort of stuff right in your glasses, and your iPhone would stay tucked away in your pocket. I'm assuming it would be all wirelessly connected, although that wasn't specifically mentioned in the report. I'm kind of interested in that future. I think a lot is going to fall to the design of the actual product and the glasses, and also as a wearer of prescription lenses, is there going to be a prescription option for this kind of product? I would have to imagine if there is, it's going to be very, very expensive. So it'll either have to be that or something that goes over the top of my existing glasses, which then severely limits the design and the potential coolness of the design. You all know how Google's little experiment with glasses went, and that didn't go so well. So I'm not entirely convinced that this is the future, but a lot of companies seem to be driving toward that future. What do you think? Would you be excited about augmented reality glasses from Apple? I like the idea. I like the concept. Execution is going to be the big, big challenge. I think that's where Apple's going to have to focus, and maybe that's why they are focusing on a product that isn't standalone, something that could be a little bit thinner, a little bit lighter, maybe a little bit less intrusive when it comes to the technology. And there are lots of different technologies and patents that Apple has been exploring. So maybe they'll be the first ones to pull it off. And if they do, it's sounding like it could be the end of this year or early 2020. And that's a lot sooner than I would have expected. But let me know what you think, maccast@gmail.com. Ah, you folks in Australia, we've been talking about this Apple store in Melbourne for a while. This is the one at Federation Square, and it has had a rough time. It seems like many in the community there, including the city council, really don't want Apple putting this store, at least not at that location. There have been protests, there have been petitions signed, all these different things have been happening. And even after Apple went back and redesigned the store, the city council and many in the area, in the community, are fighting to stop the construction of the Apple retail store at this location. Most recently, the Melbourne councillor agreed to oppose the demolition of the Yarra building, which is the building in Federation Square that will be demolished to make way for this new Apple store. And I think that's where the big point of contention is that originally this was something that I think wasn't well received in the community, the Yarra building and Federation Square in general, but now it's sort of become this iconic thing in Melbourne and people don't want it ruined. And I can totally understand that. Apple did apply for a demolition permit for the building and was granted it despite an interim protection order that was issued back in August. Now, Heritage Victoria is going to decide if that demolition permit application is going to be approved or rejected. One option Apple potentially could have for working things out with the people of Melbourne would be to simply move into the Yarra building, adapt it, and this is something they've done at other retail locations where they've taken a historic building. Now, this one, I think, is in the process of being registered as kind of historic or protected, which is maybe where a little bit of the contention is coming into play. But Apple has adapted other retail spaces before rather than tearing them down. And I think that could be a good compromise. But Apple isn't one company that's known very much for compromising on things. When they have a design or an idea that they feel is beautiful and warranted, they tend to want to go forward with it. And so it's not looking very likely that Apple is interested in that sort of compromise. More likely, what could happen is they could simply pull out of the project. We've seen them do this before. If Apple gets too much opposition in an area, they simply just drop their plans altogether. And this was something that did happen recently with their proposed store in Stockholm, Sweden. They butted up against heavy government opposition there and decided, yep, it's just not worth it. We're going to sell the land back to the government and we are out of here. So unfortunately, that just means Stockholm, Sweden is not getting a store. It could be exactly what they end up doing in Melbourne, which could be unfortunate because Apple stores, especially flagship ones, have proven to be a big draw for the areas that they go into. And that helps a lot of retail and commerce in those areas. And I guess at this point, you know, Melbourne and Federation Square, they kind of feel like they don't necessarily need Apple or they don't need it. So we'll have to see what'll happen. I know I've heard from many of you in the community who live in the area. And of course, being Apple fans, many of you actually support the Apple store. You're hoping to get an Apple store in your area. I'd love to hear from people who are also on the other side. You know, are you an Apple fan and not really excited about Apple demolishing the Yarra building and building an Apple store there? Send us your opinions and your comments, maccast@gmail.com. Some good news if you've had a third-party battery replacement in your iPhone. Mac Rumors this week received supposedly some internal Apple retail documents from a number of trusted sources that say that Apple is changing some of its policies when it comes to repairs on iPhones that have third-party batteries in them. In the past, that would void the ability for Apple to work on those phones. They wouldn't let their Genius Bar work on phones that had third-party batteries in them. I think also Apple authorized service providers were discouraged from working on phones with third-party batteries. Basically, Apple would require you to replace the entire device under their out-of-warranty program, or you just have to take it to a different place to get repair or service on it. Well, they are supposedly changing that policy. The new terms say that if the repair that needs to be done is unrelated to the battery, say a cracked screen or something like that, that the Apple Repair Center or the Apple Genius Bar can go ahead and do that repair. If the repair is battery related, they will have to replace the third-party battery, but they will do that for the standard Apple battery fee. So you'd just be paying another replacement fee. They'd put in an official Apple battery, and then they'd be able to do any of the repairs and deal with that issue. Again, that's if it's battery related. If for some reason the third-party battery can't be removed safely, it's got too much glue, you know, they've kind of overdone it, they will give you the option to have an iPhone replacement at the standard whole unit out of warranty price. So not necessarily cheap, but they are still, again, going to give you an option, whereas in the past they would have simply sent you out of the Apple store. So that is very good news for people who maybe want to get batteries a little bit cheaper through a third party. Personally, I kind of still feel that batteries, that's an area where you want to make sure you have an official part, something that is sanctioned by Apple. You're dealing with the power in your system. Fluctuations in that, poor quality in that can cause all kinds of other issues with your device. So while it tends to be a little bit more expensive, I don't think Apple's battery replacement costs are too out of the realm of reasonable, and I would want the work done officially by an Apple authorized service provider or by the Genius Bar. But that's just me personally. I know a lot of people maybe can't afford that. They want other options. And so the good news here is that you can take advantage of other options and then still get other repairs through Apple without any issues. So nice little change, and good to see Apple doing that. There have been several reports recently that Siri is sounding a little bit better in Britain and in Australia. Apparently, they have made improvements to both the British and Australian Siri voices on the HomePod. Reports are saying that the voice sounds higher quality and less robotic. It's not clear exactly what Apple did to change the voices, but it's possible that they've been using some of their machine learning efforts to tweak the voices, make them sound more natural, and that R&D could be paying off. The exact nature of the changes isn't really known, but users are generally reporting a sharper sounding voice, clearer accents, and better intonation coming from Siri. The good news is that these changes were all made on the server side, so you actually don't need to update any of your software. So if you have been thinking, hey, Siri, you're sounding pretty good, that's probably what's been going on. Remember back at CES when a couple television companies, I think Samsung first and then quickly followed by companies like LG, said that they were going to be bringing AirPlay 2 and HomeKit support to their televisions? A lot of us got very, very excited, right? Those are some cool new technologies that Apple has rolled out recently, and to be able to add that support into TVs, that would be awesome. Well, we got a little more clarity this week from LG on which TVs are going to be getting AirPlay 2 and HomeKit support, and unfortunately the news isn't quite as good as we maybe first thought. LG has said that only 2019 TVs will be getting those updates, although they did clarify when those updates would be coming. I think at CES they said later this year. Now they are saying they should be arriving sometime mid this year, so expect expect them around this summer. Of course, that is going to be a little bit disappointing for owners of 2017 and 2018 LG models. There are already, though, petitions going around, online petitions, asking LG to support those older televisions. And then finally in the news for this week, if you're an Apple Music user, you may have noticed the artwork on playlists has been looking a little bit differently recently. That's because Apple's been updating that artwork with art commissioned from several well-known artists. The idea, Apple says, is to try to better connect the playlists with their communities and with the content that is inside those playlists. In the past, Apple kind of used a generic unified design, something that really tied all the playlists together as Apple playlists, but wasn't really unique to the style of music or the kind of music that the playlist was representing. Well, apparently they are looking to change that, and they plan to redesign, quote, many thousands of Apple Music playlists with new artwork rolling out over the course of the next few months. And again, this is all being commissioned by pretty well-known artists. If you're into that community, you probably recognize some of the names. Unfortunately, as I was reading through it, I'm not very up on my current artists and pop culture, I guess. But needless to say, if you are into that sort of thing, it's probably some of your favorite artists. And I'd love to know what you think of the new artwork. Some of it's pretty cool. A lot of it's very stylized text and stuff like that. But you can definitely see it changing. And I think I kind of like it. I like the variety. I like the fact that it is more representative of the kind of music. I think music and art in a lot of ways goes hand in hand. And so to be able to kind of leverage that and take advantage of it is really cool. And just having variety when you're looking through stuff in Apple Music, I think makes things interesting. So love to know your opinions on this. Shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple show sponsors, starting with ExpressVPN. Now, admit it, most of us think that cybercrime, that's something that happens to other people, right? It doesn't happen to us. You may even think that no one wants your data or that hackers can't grab your passwords or credit card details. But if you're thinking that, yeah, you're wrong, actually. Stealing data from unsuspecting people on public Wi-Fi, that's one of the simplest and cheapest ways for hackers to make money. And when you leave your internet connection unencrypted, you're opening up your personal data like passwords and credit card numbers and just your personal information for the world to see. And that's why, for me, when I'm using any Wi-Fi that I'm not in control of, say at like an airport or a coffee shop, a restaurant, a hotel, I've been turning on and using ExpressVPN. And I like it because they make it super easy. One click and I'm protected. And I don't even notice it because it's fast. It's on, it's there, it's running, and I don't have to think about it. And that's one of the things I love about it. ExpressVPN, it secures and anonymizes your internet traffic by encrypting your data and hiding your IP address. And using ExpressVPN, I can safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped or having my personal data stolen. Plus, it's really affordable. You can start protecting yourself with ExpressVPN for less than $7 a month, and it comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. And it's the number one rated VPN service by TechRadar. So protect yourself online today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/maccast. That's expressvpn.com/maccast for 3 months free with a 1-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/maccast to learn more, and a big thank you to ExpressVPN for their support of the MacCast. I'd also like to take a moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is SimpliSafe. Now, here's something interesting. Studies show that security systems deter burglars. It's a fact, but still, there's a burglary every 8 seconds in America. How? Well, if you think about it, burglars don't give up just because some houses have security systems and others don't. Of course not. They just find a house that isn't protected, and that's why it's a necessity that you secure your home. So let me recommend a brilliant security system built by my friends at SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe believes that fear has no place in a place like home, so they made their system ridiculously smart. SimpliSafe's sensors will protect every point of access in your home, your doors, your windows, your garage, you name it, and they provide everything you need in one box that is super simple to set up and get running. You can literally do it in minutes. And best of all, SimpliSafe's 24/7 monitoring is just $14.99 a month, and they'll never lock you in to a long-term contract. More than 3 million people already know it feels good to fear less with SimpliSafe, so protect your home today with SimpliSafe by going to simplisafe.com/maccast. Go today to get free shipping and a 60-day money-back guarantee. That's simplisafe.com/maccast to protect your home and family today. SimpliSafe.com/MacCast, and a big thank you to SimpliSafe for their support of the show. Let's talk a little bit about iCloud Keychain. Apple's built-in feature for storing passwords and keychains, and more specifically, iCloud Keychain, which allows you to sync all that stuff and also ties into Safari's autofill feature and its new password suggestion tool, which I think is awesome. It will recommend to you when you're signing up or registering for a website that you use a secure password. Again, this is if you've turned on iCloud Keychain in your iCloud settings. And you've probably seen this if you've been using Safari at all recently. It works both on the Mac and on iOS, and I think it is a really good way to make sure that you're always using a unique and secure random password, because it makes that suggestion and then it will save that information right into your keychain. So the next time you go to log into that site, it prompts you and it will autofill that information for you. It's also a little bit of an annoying feature, and this is coming up because I received an email this week asking, hey, is there a way, a simple way, to kind of change how that password is generated? I don't really like the dashes that are in there, and I'm in 100% agreement with this person who emailed me. Like, the dashes is really annoying, because like a lot of things, Apple tried to make this feature really, really simple, right? Apple does these simple solutions, but simple sometimes brings with it its own limitations. What Apple is doing is generating, it looks like to me, a 20-character password, basically three groups of six characters separated by three dashes. And that's it. No exceptions. That's kind of the only way that you can generate that. Now, they do give you the option when it makes the password suggestion to tap or click the choose my own password option, and then you can actually build or write in your own password. But you may have a hard time coming up with a really secure one, or, you know, maybe you want something a little bit more randomized. You could use a third-party password manager like LastPass or 1Password, and then you could opt to only use that for doing those autofills or those password suggestions, and then still have it save into iCloud Keychain. That's sort of the workaround that I've been using, but even that's a little less than ideal. So really what this person was asking me was, do I know a way to adapt or change iCloud's keychain suggestion? And he thought, you know, maybe there would be some sort of setting in Keychain Access, the program that kind of lets you manage and control your keychain. As far as I know, there isn't. We both kind of went digging, and there doesn't seem to be any way to change that algorithm or the thing that suggests the password. So I'm turning it out to you in the community. Is there a way around this? How would you get around this? And I already mentioned kind of the way that I'm doing it, and that really is using a third-party password manager. Now, if you turn off iCloud Keychain for autofill on iOS, you do it by going into Settings, Passwords and Accounts, autofill passwords, and you can uncheck the allow filling from iCloud Keychain. On macOS, I think you go into your Safari settings and turn off the autofill options. And then you can just use the 1Password plugin or 1Password that's installed into your iOS device or LastPass, whatever your password manager of choice is, to generate those passwords. And that kind of is a way around it. But then you're disabling some of the cool features and functionality of iCloud Keychain. And I really like having both turned on because I like the autofill that comes from iCloud Keychain because it takes fewer steps. Yes, 1Password autofill is now integrated a lot better, but still iCloud Keychain just automatically fills those things in, and I just prefer it. I think it works a little bit better on that side of things. I still love and use and rely on 1Password. That is not going away, but I want the ability to use both. I'm just wishing that I could better control the password suggestions. And like I said, it'd be even better, I think, because I really like how 1Password generates passwords, if I could choose that as my default thing for suggesting passwords, and that would just autofill in. That actually would be the most ideal, in my opinion. You know, of course, you could just simply let iCloud Keychain do its autofill thing and then just replace the characters that you don't like in the password. So if it's the dashes that's bothering you, replace those with other characters, and that could work. But again, that's extra steps. It would be just be really nice if Apple would give us the ability to tweak that. I kind of thought maybe there's a text expander way around this. Like maybe I can get text expander to change those characters after the autofill suggestion, but I'm not entirely positive. I think that would take a little more scripting and I'd probably have to dig in a little bit deeper. So if someone out in the community has a good solution for this, for manipulating, changing, or changing the default suggestions for iCloud Keychain passwords, let us know. Shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. I guess the other option is we just wait for Apple to kind of change the feature. I guess a good way to do that is all of us who don't like how it is now, let's all head to apple.com/feedback and just make the suggestion to Apple. Say, hey, we really would like the ability to control the parameters of how those passwords are generated, you know, whether you want special characters, upper and lower case, whether you want hyphens between the sections, all those sorts of things. So maybe that's a good way to handle it as well. So let's all do that. And I look forward to hearing from you on your thoughts and suggestions on this. Another thing we talked about recently here on the MacCast was encryption. I believe it was in the last episode of the MacCast. I was specifically talking about File Vault. Well, this week I received this comment and question from John, who is looking for a little bit more selectivity in his encryption. Here's what John had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is John. I have sent you and left you messages before. I am listening to your most recent MacCast, and it is about the whole disk encryption. What I'm trying to do is find a way to just encrypt a folder and allow that particular folder to grow if you put in more data in there to save it. I would like to do it that way, including pictures. You know, pictures that, you know, yeah, if it goes up to the iCloud, it can then be backed up that way. But I also want it to be kind of universal that you can open it up on a PC if you need to get access to it and you need to download it. That's the version that I would like to try to get. I don't know if there's anything out there right now. I haven't seen anything. You said something about TrueCrypt, but TrueCrypt seems a little complicated. That's to me, at least. And trying to just set up a folder access only and then allow it to grow, it could be as large as over a terabyte. I wouldn't want to be, but you know, pictures becoming that large is getting to that point. So at least it's protected. Yes, I agree that Apple should find a way that you can encrypt stuff that, you know, they don't have any, that nobody can get into.
So unfortunately, the message, when you leave messages on the voicemail, there ends up being a 3-minute limit. So John went on to talk about a few other things, but I really wanted to jump in and address the encryption thing, because we had been talking about the fact that, you know, with iCloud, Apple does have the keys to some of that data. And if there's a government request or a subpoena, they can actually decrypt like iCloud backups. And we talked about what kinds of data Apple has access to decrypt and what they can't. All of this on the last episode of the MacCast. So if you missed that, go back and listen to it. But, you know, John's question is a very relevant one. You know, what if I want to protect some of my data, either locally on my machine or on external drives, but not all of it? I don't want to do whole disk encryption. I just want to protect select items, maybe your taxes, or maybe you have certain photos that you just want to make sure are protected, or whatever that might be. There's many legitimate reasons for wanting to protect all kinds of data that we have on our computers, because so much of our personal information is in there. And maybe you don't want to do the whole disk encryption thing. And even if you did, you know, with, again, your backups, if Apple has the keys, they can still decrypt that stuff. Same thing goes for other providers, right? So your best protection is to be able to encrypt it locally. You hold on to the keys, let that get backed up to the cloud, and then you can always decrypt it and no one else can. And a way to do that selectively, as I did mention, I think on the last episode, as John pointed out, TrueCrypt, which actually doesn't exist anymore. It has now become a technology called VeraCrypt. It's an open source free software. You can download it for Mac, Windows, Linux, all of the platforms, and it is a cross-platform tool that works very much the way that you're describing, John, where you can protect folders, you can protect files, whatever you want. I think it does still create kind of images, disk images or containers that you actually encrypt and then can decrypt. Unfortunately, I've played around with it, and I agree with you. It's not the slickest, easiest to use solution. The user interface does leave a bit to be desired, but again, it's free and open source. So it's a solution. It's a pretty good one. I know a lot of people who use it. I played around with it, and I think we talked about it on a past MacCast for encrypting like external USB drives. Another great application for selective encryption. So that is a solution. It is a way to do it. And as far as I know, if you want to do it cross-platform, it's the only solution that I've really seen or am aware of. Now, I'm hoping some of you in the community might have a better suggestion of something to use. And if you do, send us your emails and your comments to maccast@gmail.com. But I will say, if you're dealing with encryption and wanting to do selective encryption only on the Mac and in the way you described, John, where you want a container that can sort of be one size but grow as you add more stuff to it, you can do that with Disk Utility and a built-in smart disk, sparse bundle, disk image. And these are pretty easy to set up and create because, again, you just use Disk Utility, which is right on your Mac. Launch Disk Utility, go under the File menu, choose a new image and create a new blank image. And then in the dialog that comes up, you can choose your size. Now, when you're creating a sparse bundle, what you want to do is you want to choose the largest volume size that you'll ever need for that container. So, you know, 500 megabytes, a gigabyte, a terabyte, it doesn't matter. Create the largest size, how big you want it to eventually be able to grow to. The advantage of a sparse bundle or a sparse disk image is that it will only actually be the physical size or only use up the amount of storage of the stuff that's inside that disk image. So if you create one that's a terabyte and you only put 100 megabytes of data in it, it's only going to take up 100 megabytes of disk space on your drive. And you can keep adding stuff to it and it will grow over time. So that accomplishes that thing that you're looking for. So choose the size, then choose your format. You can choose macOS Extended Journaled or APFS now, if you have a newer operating system. And then for the image format, like I said, you're going to choose a sparse bundle disk image, or you could simply choose a sparse disk image. So you know the difference between a bundle and just a standard sparse disk image is that with a bundle, the data is put into smaller files, 8 megabytes each. And it was actually developed for things like Time Machine. It's actually the image format that Time Machine uses. And the reason it does that, breaks it up into smaller bytes, is so that it can do differential backups. So if you're using a backup system and you change just one part of the disk image, if it's just a sparse disk image, the operating system will recognize that as the entire file has changed, and it will back up the entire thing. With a sparse bundle, it can do it in these little slices, so it can detect, oh, you only changed something in this little slice, and it can do that incremental backup. So if you're using some other system that's doing incremental backup, a sparse bundle disk image is probably the better choice. And then you can choose what kind of encryption you want to put on it, 128-bit or 256-bit AES encryption, and when you do that, it will prompt you for a password or a passphrase for that encrypted disk image. So you'll set that password, make sure you use a good one, something that's hard to remember, maybe have your 1Password generate it, store it in there. You can also store it into your keychain. And if you store it in the keychain, what's nice about that is when you go to mount that disk image, you're not going to have to enter the password. If you want a little bit more security, though, don't store it in the keychain. Just remember the password, and you can enter the password every single time. And those work great. It's actually what I use for a lot of my data that I want to keep safe. Specifically, I have all of my taxes in there. I also put my Paperless, which is the application I use from Mariner Software to store all of my scanned documents. So I do everything digitally. I scan all my paper documents, my bank statements, financial statements, all that stuff into Paperless, and I have its database, its data file stored on a encrypted sparse disk bundle image, or a sparse bundle disk image. I get tongue-tied when I try to say that very frequently, but you get my point. So I store all that in there, and that's how I keep that safe and protected. That can get backed up to the cloud. It doesn't matter. I have the keys for that. It is all secure. So I think that's another great solution, and I like it because it's something that's just built into every Mac, and it's relatively easy to use. If you're looking for an even easier solution, the other thing that I'm aware of, and I've played around with in the past, but I don't use regularly, but still I think it's great software, is an application called Hider 2 from MacPaw. And this allows you to just run an application. It can do exactly what you're asking. You can select a folder, and not only can you encrypt it, but you can also hide it on your Mac. So if someone gets in there, they won't even see the folder unless they can go through Hider and actually enter the passwords and get into it and decrypt it and turn the folder back on. So you can hide your folders. It has a nice little menu bar icon. It has keyboard shortcuts so you can encrypt things. And so that may also be another option you want to try out. So there's a couple of my ideas. I'm sure the community is going to have more for us. So I welcome and look forward to your emails and your comments on this. And thanks, John, for your question. Another question I received this week has to do with something we've been talking about quite frequently on the show, and that is a future where Apple would create their own processors for the Mac, moving away from Intel processors, moving to probably an ARM-based Apple-designed processor, something that will be very interesting. I think it's eventually going to happen. I think it will happen. But it brought up the question for Sean, who is a user of Bootcamp, as to what happens when Apple moves away from Intel. Am I still going to be able to run Windows under boot camp. And I'm actually surprised how frequently I hear from members of our community who are using and running Windows on their Mac using boot camp. I think it's a very common application. I guess I shouldn't be that surprised because it's such cool technology. And why not? Why wouldn't you want to run Windows on a Mac? If you have your choice of computers and you have to run Windows, it might as well be an Apple product, right? So I'm right in line with that. But what happens when Apple does its own processors, especially if they're ARM-based processors? Are you going to be able to continue to do boot camp? Will boot camp continue to run? And when I first got this question from Sean, I was like, I don't think so. I don't know. But I ran out and I did a little bit of research, and some of you probably are already saying, hey, no, Adam, actually, Windows 10 currently runs on ARM-based processors. Microsoft has an initiative, and they actually have a version of Windows 10 that will run on ARM-based processors. I'll link to some of the information in the show notes at maccast.com, but developers can port their apps so that they will run on ARM. Now, as you might imagine, there are a few limitations to ARM-based Windows. Windows 10 on ARM runs x86 applications, also ARM32 and ARM64 applications. The ARM64 applications are what Windows calls Universal Windows Platform applications. And those applications are only available through the Windows App Store. So it's a little bit different. It's not the full catalog of Windows applications. So, you know, Windows 10 running on ARM might not suit everyone, especially if it gets supported in boot camp. Really, the biggest exception is that x86 applications need to run as their 32-bit versions. 64-bit versions cannot run on the ARM-based version of Windows 10. This is for x86 applications. But most often, there is a 32-bit and a 64-bit version. And again, if developers take the time to port their applications to the new Universal Windows Platform versions, then you do get 64-bit support on ARM. So there is a path for this. It is something that could happen. So I would imagine in a Apple CPU future, where Apple is designing processors based on ARM, Windows is still going to be an option for a lot of people. It just might be a little bit different in terms of the applications. And I know some applications maybe aren't available or won't be available, but it'll be a transition period. And we've gone through this even with macOS, right? Many of us remember the transition from IBM PowerPC to Intel processors, and there was some growing pains. And I would imagine we will have some growing pains if Apple moves to their own processors. But ultimately, it seeming like boot camp and Windows will continue to mostly work. And I think there's enough people out there that do that, that it is in Apple's best interest to make sure that it works as well as possible. So I wouldn't worry about it too much, Sean. I think we're probably a few years away from even seeing a Mac with an ARM-based processor yet. And technology moves fast. A lot of things change. And I'm sure Windows will change along the way as well. So we'll just have to wait and see on that one. Something else we talked about recently here on the MacCast is Shortcuts and the Shortcuts application on iOS. And I am starting to find more and more uses for doing automation on my iOS devices, and I'm using Shortcuts more and more. And I think we all are starting to do that. And more third-party apps are starting to bring in Shortcuts support, and that's making iOS and the ability to automate things much, much more powerful. But I know it can be a little bit daunting to get started. On a recent episode of the MacCast, we tried to cover kind of a little basic shortcut application, and I encouraged you all to go out and maybe download some shortcuts and load them into the application and just start tweaking them and start seeing how they work and how they tick. And I still think that is a great way to discover shortcuts and maybe move into taking the next steps to kind of build your own shortcuts. But since then, we've had a number of listeners who have emailed in and recommended shortcuts. And this week, listener Greg wrote in and suggested one that he really likes called Park or Where You Parked. And I will have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It basically lets you mark where you parked, and then later can give you Google Maps and walking directions back to your parking space. So we've all been in this situation, right, where you park your car and then you forget where you park it. Here's a solution for that. And I know there's other solutions. You know, there's a thing built into Apple Maps that'll let you do this. But this is just another great option and something you could set up with a Siri shortcut and all those sorts of things. So again, it's another great way to get into shortcuts. But something else Greg also pointed out when he sent me the link to this was a great gallery website for finding and sharing shortcuts. And a couple of these are popping up. And that's really what I wanted to talk to you about this week is finding additional shortcuts, because you can actually share shortcuts. Apple has the ability for you to upload them into your iCloud library, and you can create links to them. You can share them through the share sheet in the shortcuts application. So you can send them to your friends and family. And so if you come up with a particularly great and useful shortcut, you can share those with people. And this website is called shortcutsgallery.com. So shortcutsgallery.com, you can go there and they have all of the kinds of different categories and people upload different shortcuts. And so if you're looking for a shortcut to do something, or maybe one that you want to tweak to do something, or maybe you're just trying to learn shortcuts and figure out how these things work, here is a great resource for you. Another big champion of iOS and a guy who I think uses iOS devices exclusively for his day-to-day work is Federico Vitici over at Mac Stories. And as you might imagine, he is a huge fan of shortcuts, and he's been building up quite an archive himself of shortcuts that he uses. And this week, he also started sharing those. So Mac Stories now also has a shortcut gallery. So if you go to macstories.net/shortcuts, they have all 150 shortcuts and growing broken down into all kinds of categories and sections, things like Mac and Markdown and text, weather, even JavaScript. Did you know that you could do JavaScript inside your shortcuts and deal with JSON data and all kinds of cool stuff? So if you're a coder or developer, yeah, these things are pretty darn powerful, and it is really amazing what you can potentially do with them. So go out, explore shortcuts. There's a couple resources for you this week here on the MacCast, and let me know what you're building and creating. If you make something really, really cool, share it with me, MacCast@gmail.com. All right, finally in the show for this week, I have a thing of the moment. I know it's been a while since we've done one of these. Things of the moment are just things that I am discovering. It could be software, it could be hardware, little cool things that I am using in my daily Apple and Mac life. And this week, after much frustration with my HomeKit setup, specifically my Insteon Home Hub, HomeKit edition, which now died on me for the second time. It gave up the ghost. It does this thing where it just, the power unit on it fails and it just starts flashing red. So suddenly I couldn't control my lights anymore, my Insteon lights, and they already replaced the switch one time. And honestly, I'm just frankly done with it. I had these Insteon wall switches. They were great because they were one of the first to support HomeKit. But frankly, Insteon's HomeKit integration and support has proven to be not very good. It's been less than stellar since the very beginning. It's always kind of been flaky. It would, you know, not work sometimes, work sometimes. It would have these weird little quirks and issues. And I kind of suffered through it, but this week or this past week when it died again, that was it for me. And I have decided that generally any product that's a HomeKit product that requires a hub, I have not been impressed with. So I said, that's it. I'm going to replace these switches. I'm going to do it with something that does not require a hub because I am done with hubs. And I invested in and found two iDevices dimmer switches. I'll have a link to these in the show notes at maccast.com. These are replacements. So what I'm replacing, just to be clear, is my in-wall switches. I had a couple of in-wall switches. They needed to be three-way switches. iDevices will also do four-way. So if you're looking for four-way dimmer switches, they have wall switches and dimmer switches. So you can do either. I will tell you, they are not the cheapest solution out on the market. They do retail for about $80 US each, so $79.95. But I have to say, I think you get what you pay for, really. I mean, the hubs just are such a problem. I mean, with the Insteon stuff, to add insult to injury, because the hub was actually broken, I couldn't remove my wall switches from the home app. It literally would not give me the removal option. Now, luckily, removing the hub itself, that was something I was able to do from inside the home app, and it pulled all of its associated devices, meaning the wall switches, along with it. So thank goodness I got those out of there. But man, how annoying. I know there's a lot of people out there that have the Philips Hue system, and I know that uses a hub, and you really, really like it, but man, it's just not for me anymore. It just really, really isn't. And so I bought these iDevices dimmer switches. I did have to install them, and luckily iDevices has a really great how-to video. Also, the little instruction booklet that comes with it is great. Plus, I had the added advantage that with my Insteon switches, I did have a licensed electrician install those, and so all of the wires and things were clearly labeled, and I was basically swapping them out one for one. So one of the challenges when you're doing a three-way is you have to have a primary and a secondary, and there is a thing called a traveler wire. Yeah, it gets a little bit into electrician level stuff. So I will tell you, if you're not comfortable working with electricity or installing this kind of thing directly, get a licensed electrician to do it for you. You know, there are codes and things that you have to adhere to. So while you can do it yourself, and there's a lot of people that do it DIY, I did it myself. You know, be safe. Make sure that anytime you're dealing with electricity, if you're not comfortable, you get a professional to do it for you. But mine were in a three-way setup. I was able to get them easily installed in an afternoon. And after installing them, there was a little bit of programming. I did have to pair the two switches. But what was really nice about these switches versus my Insteons is there were easy to press and clearly labeled buttons. I was up and running in a couple of minutes once I had the switches installed, and it was great. The whole process was really, really great. It was also very easy to add the devices to my HomeKit setup. I just installed the app. The switches themselves have a great little pullout tab that has the HomeKit code and information on them, just to emphasize the difference between the iDevices and the Insteon. My Insteons had the code numbers inside the switches. They were like on the side of the physical switch. So you had to take the wall plate off. You had to get under there. Why they did that, I have no idea, because this is information you need access to if you ever need to reset anything. So, so annoying. About the only issue that I had with the iDevices ones was that I did have one of my gang boxes that was a bit tight, and when I put the switch into it, it pushed down on the little pullout tab, you know, the plastic case. It was pushed down just tightly enough that it was a little bit hard to pull that pullout tab out. So I did have to kind of get a little pair of pliers to actually pull on it, because it was hard to grab onto. There is a little kind of notch that you could normally just put your thumbnail behind and pop that out. But again, this one was tight in the gang box, so not really anything I could do much about. And I don't really fault iDevices for that. It was more just how my house was set up. Another nice thing about the iDevices switches is they have a little LED on the front of them. They call it a night light. So when you turn the switches off at night, you can have the little night light come on, and it lights up the switch, making it easy to find the wall switch in the dark. And the LED on that can actually be controlled in terms of the color. It's purple by default, which is the iDevice's color. But you can change that in the app, and you can also change the brightness of that. So if you have it in a room where you don't want a big bright light there, you can tone it down. If you want something brighter, you can turn it up. And that's all controllable inside the app, inside a home, the Home app, and also through Siri and HomeKit. And what was interesting about the LED nightlight is within the Switch itself, and this is just something related to, I think, HomeKit devices, is that that light is treated as a service of the parent Switch. And so you can actually give the service its own Siri name so that you can address it in Siri as something different. Unfortunately, that little light is not able to be separated from the device itself. So when the device is assigned to a room, the service is also in that same room. And the reason that's a bummer is that technically, if I ask Siri to do something with my living room lights, meaning all of the lights that are in the living room, it would adjust both the Switch and the nightlight. So specifically, because this is a dimmer Switch, if I tell it to, you know, change the dim level of, or the lighting level of the living room lights to 50%, it's going to set both of the nightlight and the living room lights themselves at 50% brightness, and there doesn't seem to be a way to separate those two things. So that's a little quirk, but not a really big deal. Another really nice thing about these Switches is they have a double tap option on the Switch itself, so that when you double tap the rocker switch on the top, it goes up to the maximum brightness of the lights. If you double tap on the off down section of the Switch, it will go to the minimum brightness of that Switch. And that is another nice thing, that when you go to set it up, it walks you through setting the dimming levels on your lights. Anybody who has worked with LED lights or compact fluorescent lights on a dimmer switch knows that one of the challenges is that depending upon how your switch is and how your lights are, if you get to certain brightness levels, you can start to get a flickering effect. And so the iDevices switches have a way to work around that, where they walk you through a little wizard of setting the dimming levels, and they will check to see what's the lowest level you can go to where you don't get flicker, what's the brightest level, and how to create a smooth dim effect across that light. And it'll walk you through the whole thing, and it worked great. I haven't had, luckily, any issues with the flickering thing, but if you have suffered from that with your lights, this could potentially help you work around that. So I just installed them today. They haven't been up and running for too long, but I can tell already, one, they respond much more quickly than my Insteon lights. And I don't know if that's because of the built-in hub, or them being hubless. Basically, each switch has its own quote-unquote hub. It's not even really a hub. It can just talk directly to HomeKit. And so I'm very impressed so far. I am loving the new switches. I will, of course, update you if that changes. But after my experience with my LifeX bulbs, which are also hubless and I absolutely love, I am pretty thoroughly convinced that I'm never going back to another hub-based HomeKit product ever again, if I can ever avoid it. I know it may be unavoidable at one point as I build out my smart home network, but man, paying a little bit more and getting hubless products, I think, is worth it, at least for me. I'd love to know your thoughts and opinions on this. If you have other products, or if you have the iDevices products, let me know. Shoot me an email or an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But for this week, my thing of the moment is iDevices dimmer switches. So check those out. I'll have a link to them in the show notes at maccast.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your emails and audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Just be aware there is a 3-minute time limit, so leave a brief message, and I look forward to receiving those. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And then finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/the MacCast. But that will do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.